This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. Arguably, the most important piece of domestic U.S. legislation of the 20th century is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The section is devoted to keeping discrimination out of the workplace was called Title VII. Can't discriminate because of race, color, religion, national origin, or because of sex. Because of sex, one law, 10 cases, and 50 years that changed American women's lives at work is a new book. The author's with us, Jillian Thomas. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Title VII sets up the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. It's focused on racial discrimination largely at first. 1966, Ida Phillips is a Florida mom. She applies for which job?
To be an assembly line trainee at Martin Marietta, the defense contractor in Orlando, Florida.
So she goes in. What does the receptionist tell her?
First she asks, do you have any kids who are in preschool? And Ida Phillips answers yes. She has a 3-year-old daughter. And the receptionist says, no application for you.
She can't apply because she has kids, little kids.
Yes. Now, the company didn't impose the same requirement on men who were applying, but women who had small children weren't eligible to apply.
I guess what? A sense that somehow women at that time had a greater duty to the kids and they didn't want something at the company.
Yeah, more like a stereotype that they were unreliable workers, that they were going to be absent more or late more, or they were going to be taking calls during the day, or just generally that they weren't going to want to be there and work as hard, whereas fathers were, of course, presumed to have wives at home taking care of those problems.
So it's a fascinating story about how civil rights lawyers see the importance of this case and move it forward. But just to remind us, what happened to her at that moment may not have been illegal, and the company tried to make the case that it was perfectly okay.
Yeah, I mean, the company pointed to its workforce, which was actually majority women, and said, how can we be discriminating against women? We hire mostly women. So it was the issue of it being a subset of women. It was women with children. And they said, that's not sex discrimination. That's just a business decision.
All right. So that does become the sort of company behavior that is not permitted under the rules in the U.S. But back then, when Ida Phillips and team are fighting this case, there's no national organization for women yet. You work now as a staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union's Women's Rights Project. That project is not even up and running at that point.
Correct.
This is sort of infrastructure that comes along.
That's right. Ida Phillips was very, very much on her own. I mean, practically anyone who brings a lawsuit that goes as far as the Supreme Court is pretty isolated. But in terms of the interest groups that we now think of as women's organizations, she had nothing.
Now, Ida Phillips is white. She finds an African-American attorney who takes her case.
She was smart. She inquired of a white attorney who she'd gotten the name of from a friend, and he told her she had no case. And it occurred to her, you know, I'll bet the lawyers who are going to really know anything about discrimination on the job are African-American lawyers. So I'm going to look for one of those. And the one she picked was a guy who was running for judge in Jacksonville. And he told her he was too busy, but he had a young associate, Reese Marshall, who had just completed an internship at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York. And he took the case.
All right. The process is fascinating beyond that. Now, many more cases detailed in the book. Women used to pay more per month for their pensions because women statistically live longer. And then there's a chapter here reminding us that the phrase sexual harassment didn't used to exist.
No, it didn't exist until 1975. And even then, the existence of the phrase didn't mean that it was accepted as a legal proposition. So it really was in the late 1970s and into the 1980s that women started trying to use Title VII to get justice for sexual harassment they experienced. They only began to when they were able to show that it had cost them financially. So, the standard pattern was a supervisor propositions, subordinate refuses, supervisor fires subordinate. That's something the courts began to be able to understand was discriminatory because it hurts your wallet. But what we think of now is hostile work environment where you just have someone talking dirty or touching you or leering at you or propositioning you without following through on it. That they couldn't get. That seemed personal.
But it's different now.
thanks to the bravest woman of all, Michelle Vinson, who brought the case that ended up being the first case decided by the Supreme Court about sexual harassment in 1986. She endured actually what was criminal behavior, really, at the hands of her boss for about 3 years. But the problem was that she never had that hit to her wallet that I mentioned. She actually retained her job, was never fired, and in fact continued getting promotions. And so the question was, just is a psychological injury alone and a polluted environment alone a violation of the law? And the court said it was.
Michelle Vinson worked for a bank in the D.C. area. Now, if you think any of this is ancient history, take us to 1984. I mean, that's a year that the Apple Macintosh is launched. It seems like our era, not ancient history. Ann Hopkins tries to make partner at the accountant Price Waterhouse and gets turned down for what?
She was the only woman out of 88 candidates, and she had the highest book of business, but she was turned down because the partners assessing her wrote in their comments that she was macho, needed a course at charm school, overcompensated for being a woman, swore, used bad language for a lady partner, and even her champion at the firm, when she asked him, how do I overcome these barriers, told her, well, why don't you walk more femininely, talk more femininely, wear makeup, style your hair, and wear jewelry?
And so her case is crucial.
It really affected a sea change for not just women, but everybody in the workplace who doesn't conform to some sort of gender stereotype. And that's why it was so revolutionary. There was actually social psychologist testimony explaining what gender stereotypes are and how they work and keep us all in little boxes and how we're punished for stepping outside of them. And the Supreme Court agreed unanimously on that point. There's a famous line in the decision, I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of, if the only thing you can think of to correct in an applicant is the shade of her lipstick, maybe it's her gender and not her lipstick. That's the problem.
Jillian Thomas, what is a new frontier for this now? I mean, LGBT, transgender people in the workplace?
I do think that, along with discrimination against mothers and pregnant women, which just remains completely pernicious and takes new and more difficult forms every day, but the frontier where the most growth is occurring is in relation to LGBT workers. And actually, speaking of Ann Hopkins, that ruling by the Supreme Court that sex stereotypes, that punishing someone for being the wrong kind of woman or the wrong kind of man, is just the same as discriminating against all women or all men. And so that that precedent has proved invaluable to trans workers first, but LGB workers are now getting more success as well, very much aided by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which has the authority to issue interpretations of the law and bring litigation. And they've done both on behalf of LGBT workers.
Now, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act is now being invoked in this case involving the restrooms and North Carolina.
The Justice Department has just sued the state of North Carolina for its so-called bathroom bill, which provides that anyone in state buildings, including the University of North Carolina, must use the restroom that accords with their gender marked on their birth certificate. And this Justice Department alleges that that's a violation for the workers who work in those buildings. That's a violation of Title VII's prohibition on discrimination because of sex. And there's been some pushback from opponents of the Justice Department action and supporters of the North Carolina law, saying, well, this isn't something that was ever intended by the framers of the Title VII
sex provision. They didn't sit around talking about transgender issues during the debate in Congress in the 1960s is what they're arguing.
Sure, but they also didn't debate sexual harassment. They didn't debate sex stereotyping. They didn't debate same-sex sexual harassment, which has been found illegal by the Supreme Court. And they certainly couldn't have envisioned three Supreme Court justices being women or a female presidential candidate. So the cultural reality of the legislators at the time they enacted the law can't be our only touchstone.
Where does this go next? I mean, what do we know about the federal court that applies in North Carolina?
Well, North Carolina sits within the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit just within the last month or so found in favor of a trans teenager who wanted to use the boys' bathroom in his high school because that corresponded with his current gender identity, and the court found in his favor. Now, that was in Title IX, which is an analog to Title VII but governs education, but the two laws inform one another, so North Carolina is going to have an uphill battle in this one for sure.
Jillian Thomas is a staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union's Women's Rights Project. The book is called Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Jillian Thomas, thank you.
Thank you.